The Breakfast Huddle replay from Money FM 89.3.
Our next guest is a former magistrate, coroner, deputy public prosecutor, and state counsel. He's got a legal career spanning over three decades. But today, he's best known as a champion of retail investors' rights in his capacity and founding president and CEO of the Securities Investors Association of Singapore, or SIAS. We welcome into the studio the CEO of SIAS, David Gerald. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Well, David, congratulations on the 20th anniversary. So what will the celebrations be like?
Well, today we launch 20th anniversary and we go on to a global investment conference in July. And then we'll have the Corporate Governance Week, this time truly global. More speakers, more panelists coming from overseas. And then we'll have, beyond the Corporate Governance Week, the award ceremony, and then Investor Day. And that would be like an investor rally. And then we'll also have, I think we need to have some fun, so we might have a concert in the first quarter of, you know, next year. There's life is dull without song and music, you know?
Song and dance,
that's right.
You know, David, when I started learning a little bit about finance, a friend who was teaching me that constantly referenced the clock issue back in 1998, the Central Limit Order Book.
Yes.
And that really was where the birth of SIAS kind of took its roots. Singaporeans who were trading Malaysian shares on this platform suddenly found those shares frozen by the Malaysian government. If you could help us out, take us back to that situation about 20 over years ago. What was the hardest part in handling that episode, David?
The most unexpected event in our financial industry was that where Malaysian government decided to seize the shares of Singaporeans who have invested in 112 listed companies in Malaysia. Now, this came as a shock. Malaysia was in need of money and they decided to do this way was most disheartening. But we were stranded. There wasn't an organized voice. They refused to speak to or settle the issue with the government of Singapore. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to settle it with mums and pops. Can you imagine Mahathir talking to small investors? And so that prompted me, after 9 months of waiting for someone to put up his or her hand, to actually organize these people into SIAS and then to provide the one voice. The hardest part was to convince investors that this is going to be a long, drawn-out, you know, affair. If you go to court and you can't, they wanted me to sue. They wanted me to take legal action. But legal action then would not have resulted in a profitable result, because Malaysian courts will take very long time. I had faith in Malaysian judges then, but the system and the Mahathir, the prime minister then in charge, was very, very strong. He was a strong man, and he was almost one man's voice, you know, one voice in Malaysia. So that was the hardest part.
Yeah, it was a very turbulent time back then, of course. And after SIAS successfully handled the CLOB issue, which was the organization's primary purpose, you continued to run. Why did you decide to do that? And now it's more than 20 years and you, I guess, made some interesting discoveries, and it's been an incredible journey for you.
It's been a very interesting journey. Yes, arduous journey. But we had to concentrate firstly and foremost on investor education, because knowledge was most important, I thought. They invested in Malaysia without knowing why. They didn't know any of the stocks. They just heard the remiser telling them this may be a good stock. So we thought that when we went to north, south, east, west of Singapore during CLOB campaign, I came to the conclusion that investor education was most important, was immediate. And therefore, I embarked on that widely, from financial planning to teaching them about investment products and how to do a portfolio and how to prepare themselves for, you know, a successful investment journey for their retirement. All of them were complaining to me that they are losing money. But investing without knowledge was gambling, and that's what they were doing.
David, fast forward 20 years, and as the CEO of SIAS, general question, how do you find Singaporeans' financial literacy today?
Okay, today is far more advanced. You know, today we are in IT world and digital world. They are all getting information very fast. They're able to access IT, internet, and get information, right? Question is how to decide which information should be, you know, taken in.
It's very hard. So
SIS is there. MoneySense, we are very fortunate to have a national MoneySense program which uses, actually works with SIS very, very closely. We have covered SIS itself, we have covered something like 210,000 citizens over the last 20 years. We have done over 1,100 or 200 programs. And the idea is to keep drilling into these ordinary people that investor education should be foremost in their minds. They should get knowledge first before investing. Products are very complicated. They are not like in 1999, just stocks and unit trusts. It is now, you know, structured products, listed and unlisted. Unlisted products come with a lot of difficulties, right? So they need all the time to have reference. They need to study. They need to know. They need to know the risks first. We always tell them, don't look at the returns, look at the risks. And we have, for instance, last year we did 154 investor education programs. That's 3 a week. Enormous. But we had to do that because they have issues and we need to help them.
Yeah, indeed. You know, markets do have a short-term memory. That's what they say. Do you find now people, investors are looking at returns before considering risks?
More people are doing that now. As you know, literacy levels have changed and they have increased and more and more people are educated. The younger ones in particular are able to decipher for themselves the risks. And we always emphasize on that. And that message is getting through. But the old ones, the aged members, they still need help and they can't plow through the annual reports. So we have special programs for them to simplify annual reports, simplify investments. That's why we did so many last year. And the previous year, we did 90 over. So we'll continue to do as many as we can. And that would be the answer. They need to keep coming for education.
You know, I'm always interested in comparing my birth nation of Australia. I've been in Singapore for 18 years.
Yes.
And, you know, financial education and literacy in Australia and Singapore. And obviously, Singaporeans are quite different to Australians and their habits. But where would you say Singapore stands versus other countries when it comes to financial education and literacy?
Well, there has been a marked improvement in the need and the provision of investor education ever since MoneySense was inaugurated in, I think, 2002. The government, MAS, has been stepping up investor education at all levels and working with partners like SIS and other, you know, bodies. And that's the difference. We have a government-owned investor education station here that actually promotes investor education. But the difference between Australia and Singapore is that there you have people who are prepared to do research themselves. All right? They look at the reports, they go into the internet, they look at the company. That is now happening amongst the younger people in Singapore. I lived in Melbourne for 6 years, and let me tell you that even a taxi driver will talk to you about the stock.
Yeah, true. Yes.
And then he will analyze it for you, right? He is literate, and he will look at it thoroughly before he makes a decision, and that seems to be the norm there. Which is what our desire has been, to get our investors to first do research, ask questions, don't be in a rush, and then make your decision, you know. So always use example. If you get into an MRT at Toa Payoh, you can get off at Bishan if you're not happy.
Right?
Right. Don't wait till the end and then you find.
Don't wait till you're in Woodlands.
So take your time, you know, don't be in a rush and don't listen to the Joneses.
SIS, as a non-profit organization, it has charity status now. Walk us through, how much does it cost to run SIS and where does the funding come from? And do you feel we need more government support financial-wise?
Well, I'm glad someone's over radio asking me this. But, you know, it's been the biggest problem for CRs, us raising funds. And, you know, we've been criticized publicly and people say we are taking money from companies. That's not right. It gives a perception that we are beholden to companies. But we work with companies and financial institutions to provide the necessary funding for our investor education programs. But we draw a line. We have demonstrated in the case of one bank, which gave us 100 over 1,000 for a year, and then told us that we can't interfere with the bank's matter in ALISCO, that when things went wrong and when we said, you got to put it right, and they didn't like, they withdraw the money. I said, goodbye. We part as friends, and we don't want your money anymore for education. So we draw a line, and fortunately, all companies and financial institutions know where they stand, and CRS has demonstrated adequately that we are independent. That's number one. Number two, yes, we need about 2.4 to 2.5 million a year to run all these programs. As you know, we also do corporate governance. We do tracking of companies. We rate them, and then we give them awards. We also do dispute resolution. Now, that has stepped up because you see example like Hyflux. We do now public closed-door meetings, that is, dialogue sessions, town hall meetings. Mm. We did 35 within 18 months. Why? Because we need the company senior management to be on stage with us, with lawyers and with financial advisors pro bono, because CRS is able to get that, the best of lawyers and the best of financial advisors, to walk through the documents and to help them understand the issues so that they can make an informed decision. Now, if they're on their own having to read that voluminous documents, I don't know whether you've seen these documents, they are very difficult for myself to understand. I'm a lawyer, but I'm not a financial expert. How about housewives and how about ordinary retirees? They can't. So we need to help them. And that has helped them to make an informed decision. So I have adopted a new model of activism, and it's called in the boardroom and not the courtroom. Very successful, and it's a model not found anywhere in the world. And therefore, we get overseas visitors from U.S. Treasury, we get from OECD, we get from European Parliament, all come to find out how is it that CRS is working this way in a tripartite manner and resolving issues. How do you sit with company boards? How do you sit with regulatory committees, MAS, SGX? But we have our own views, and they respect our views. They don't tell us what to do.
Personal question. You studied law at NUS. You were actually born in Malaysia. You grew up in Sri Lanka. And it was there that you actually observed the minorities being discriminated against. For you, what drives you to fight for the underdog? What did you experience? What did you observe that pushed you?
I was only about 10 or 11 years old when I saw people being killed. I saw bloodshed. Yeah. You know, every time someone asks me this question, I go, I'm in a different world. I feel so sorry for the underdog. I would, even in school, if a boy is being attacked, however frail or small I am, then I would intervene. You know, I would not sit back and allow injustice or a bully to get away. I have always been known in school and at place of work, and I saw someone robbing a lady the handbag. And I was at the traffic light, and I had immediately my reaction was to beat the traffic light, illegal, but I had to run after the robber. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's dangerous, but that's my style.
Your instinct.
That's my instinct.
Yeah.
So people ask, why do you do this? I said, I can't sit back and watch injustice. So when it fitted me well when I was a magistrate in courts, I could do justice, right? But I came out to do this because thousands of small people were being bullied.
You're telling us off air that you were a keen soccer player at one point. You played with Dollar Kassim at Larkin Stadium in Johor Bahru. And that's one of the organizations you've helped set up over the years, the Ex-National Soccer Players Club for Retired Footballers. Also, there's Apex Club East working with charity. So what else is on your plate, and how do you manage to juggle your time with everything?
Ever since I was in the university, I was president of the University Law Society, and I was very involved then You know, in 68, the British were leaving Singapore, and the government was quite rightly introducing legislation to encourage investment and to curtail some of the rights of workers. And we were following the British system, and we had to then demonstrate to people wanting to come into Singapore that Singapore would be the ideal location for investments. But we as students, we had other ideas. We were following ILO's and United Nations standards, and I was taking up the cudgels for the workers. When later I was posted to the Labour Ministry, and I knew that I started realizing what I was then standing for back in the university was very different from what I have to implement, right? So I was always involved in community work. I was president of the UN Association in Singapore. I was very much impressed with the United Nations, especially the Security Council work. Mm-hmm. And that was institution. That was a subject I did in university and specialized. And therefore, I really enjoyed UN work. And then I was involved in various other society work, like Apex Club East, which was like, you know, doing social work, helping people on the ground, collecting newspapers or giving old clothes to people who need. When I was a coroner, I realized that lawyers didn't understand doctors and doctors didn't understand lawyers. All right, so if the doctor were to say, "Your Honor, I did a laparotomy," and the lawyer stands up and say, "Which laboratory?" You know, so I myself didn't understand, right? So I thought the only way is to bring lawyers and doctors together. So together with the late Professor Chow Sii Cheng, we started the Medical Legal Society, which is doing very well now. So most of the associations I was involved in, I was trustee of the church, and I was involved in quite a few others, like the Serangoon Garden Country Club. But more importantly, it is not the club work that I'm very proud of. It is how individuals who needed help and came across me, and I was able to help them. I think this is what professionals, quite a number, are doing, and we need to do. Because if we depend on government to do everything, you're not going to get very far, right? They can't be doing everything. So we have to, as professionals, as individuals, responsible citizens, we got to look to the left and right and see who really need help, and we need to extend our helping hand.
You started SIAS back in 1998. 20 years is a long time, and your name is pretty much synonymous with SIAS right now. So I guess the question is, after such a long time, the question of succession planning is something that you must have thought about. Where are your plans right now?
Right now, I've identified and brought in at least 3 possible candidates. But in future, what the committee says is we need 3 leaders who would do 3 things. One would do investor education, another would do corporate governance, and the third one would do a dispute resolution. All of these I'm now heading. So they are working full time. Look, I don't look 75 and I'm vibrant and healthy. God is good to me. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. This is my passion. This is my baby. So as soon as they see signs of me slowing down, I'm getting weaker and I'm unable to manage, they will step in. We got very good, well-qualified and very good candidates who can manage SIAS very well over the next 20 years.
David Gerald, the founding president and CEO of the Securities Investors Association of Singapore. David, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the 20th anniversary of SIAS.
Thank you very much.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.